You're still here. It's getting closer, though, isn't it? Yeah, it's a whole kind of its own kind of practice, the last day of a retreat, and I hope it's feeling fruitful for you, even in its roller coaster experience. So do you have some energy to hear some of the Dhamma? Okay, good. Yeah. So we thought it would be helpful today to hear some about the Buddhist teachings on the Eightfold Noble Path, one of his many lists. Who's familiar with the Eightfold Noble Path? Yeah, okay. It's many of us. Some of us not. It's always new. Somebody in the one of the groups today was saying, you know, in a very kind way, you know, the teachings are kind of all the same. You hear the same thing. it's true. And I personally don't get tired of hearing them, and I've been listening to them probably, I don't know, well over 40 years. So something to be said about this kind of nutriment. So, you know, even though we didn't give a formal talk on the Four Noble Truths, it's exactly what we've been practicing all week, you know, recognizing what brings happiness and what leads to unhappiness, which is the second noble truth. And the good news is the third is that that's not the end of the story. You know, there's a way out of that cycle of discontent and suffering or difficulty or pain and sorrow. In the midst of pain and sorrow, there's the paradox. You know, can we find peace, you know, in the midst of these worldly conditions of praise and blame and sorrow and pain and blame and fame, disrepute? You know, these worldly conditions are with us, unavoidable. So as many of you have spoken today in the small groups, you know, some of the big questions are, how do I, either I don't want to leave retreat, or how do I bring what I'm experiencing here home into my life? And how do you practice with them with really different conditions where clearly these are sublime conditions in the sense that, you know, the food is made for you, you know, the environment is pretty cushy, you know, and we're around nature, and, you know, you were able to, you know, put down the responsibilities of work, home. So these are very ripe conditions to study directly from direct experience, the working of the mind and heart. And a lot of fruit comes from that. Even if you're sitting there saying, I could have practiced a little better, you know, or I wish it happened this way, or I didn't get this insight, or it's just this, you know. It really, just don't even worry about it. It's like that music in the dentist office, you know. Can you shut it off? No, it's a program. It's all run in this big program we have. Like, there's no button I can push to shut it off. Okay. So the Buddha talked about this, you know, very directly in the Eightfold Noble Path. That's the fourth noble truth. Like, there, not only is there a way out besides not living anymore, but there's, and who knows what that's like, right? But there's a way through, and there's a way to live in life that that can really embody these teachings, and that is just simply true. And the only reason why I'm saying that to you, it's not because I read a book about it, or, you know, I have the whole scholarly teachings of the Buddha in my brain. It's not that. It's just from direct experience of this practice. And that you have, and that you can cultivate. So if anything we could say, that would probably be it. Like, keep on. You know, keep on, because it will bear fruit, unquestionably. So what are some of the specifics that support that fruit bearing, so to speak? Well, one in this Eightfold Path, and I won't be talking about all of them. We'll get through what we can get through. But the first one, and the foundational one, is called wise view. It's also called like right view, but I prefer the word wise view, since we're trying to get away from right, wrong, good, bad. So wise view, you know, wise understanding. Well, what is that? Well, many of you could answer that question easily from your practice over these last 4 days. One way to understand one level of wise view is what leads to happiness? What leads to suffering? So one can learn that just from really wishing that your sitting was different. Just one meditation sitting, one part of the sitting. Really wishing that there wasn't pain in the knee or the back, or the mind wasn't restless, or this memory that really upsets me wasn't coming, wasn't showing up. And, we know what it's like. We're in relationship to those mind states that we don't want them to be there. Like, I would really scream what I'm just saying right now, because it's like that, isn't it? It's like, get me out of here. But guess what? That's not going to happen. So what do you do? You really see what happens when we can release around it, when we don't just follow it. Thinking isn't bad, but it's a little overrated. we kind of treat it like it's God, and that's got some problems in it, So sometimes it's very, very useful. I wouldn't be doing this right now if I didn't use thoughts, right? But when we're sitting, we also get to see those thought loops that really feeding into them or trying to use more thought to get rid of them, it just doesn't work. What do I mean by work? It just leads to more distress. So you have understood in your practice, here's wise view. What leads to release of that stress? Well, one, acceptance. What's actually happening? Unpleasant, aversion, trying to get rid of, just even meeting what's actually happening can help release the stress. We're basically just recognizing through mindfulness what is actually going on. We're not recognizing through mindfulness that bliss is going to be happening. We recognize what's going on. We're equally recognizing when there is a blissful state or a peaceful state. So you can watch the grasping around that too, or the fear of it. Is it okay to feel this? Yes. Yeah, why not? Feel the feeling in the feeling. But it does come and go like everything. And there's the other part of wise understanding. So we see that what leads to suffering is that grasping, trying to get rid of what we don't like, trying to hold on to what we like, and what leads to freedom. Letting go. What does that even mean? Just being present with what is, trusting the nature of life. Things come and go. That's a deeper insight. Change. When you really pay attention, change is constant, isn't it? Isn't it interesting? Have you ever found that when you just pay attention to the body without it's got to be this way or that way, it's like boom, 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 boom. All these changing sensations. That's life. We're aware of life. And that's true with, it's true with our thoughts. It's true with our ideas about ourselves. Good and bad, as someone pointed out today. It doesn't mean that we have to doubt the recognition of generous qualities in ourselves or kindness. Those are qualities we want to cultivate. Those are energies we want to cultivate. But if you say to yourself, I'm really a generous person, what's going to happen? What are you going to notice? All the ways that you're not generous, right? Because we're not locked in. We're human beings. I like to think I'm a generous person, but then my practice is when I'm cutting up a piece of cake. do I give my wife the big one? Or do I take the big one? And that's a practice. It's interesting how difficult it can be sometimes. Give her the hook. It's funny at this human being, you know, yes, it's good we can have a sense of humor. But practicing generosity, it is even weird to say practicing it, because what does that mean? Like, it's not real? You know, it's inclining the mind towards generosity. And that can happen in so many ways. You know, here's where we're moving into, like, wise thought. So we can release from the negative thought. It might still come up again and again and again, but maybe we believe it a little less. Or we just say, oh, there it is. And in the Buddha's story of the Buddha, I'm sure many of you know this, when the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, the story is that Mara, which is a personification of these negative states of mind, would be like, yeah, you think you can get free? What about this? You know, what about lust? What about greed? What about the thing you did in this last lifetime? You know, and on and on. And, you know, the Buddha is so beautiful. So if you think of this human condition, the Buddha put his hand onto the earth and touched the earth, and in touching the earth said, by the nature of being alive, I am worthy. I am worthy of this unshakable liberation of mind and heart. And that was no saint, that was no god, that was no deva, that was a human being. That was a human being. You know, he didn't say, I'm making a deal that all these things will just go away forever. It's not true. Just like a lot of spiritual leaders, you know, people didn't like him. People tried to kill him. You know, it's not like life in India was, you know, hunky-dory. He still had to deal with the conditions of life. And this is true for us. So how do we, you know, engage in, we understand wise view, what leads to suffering, what leads to its release. We understand the changing nature of things. We understand that just by the nature that things change all the time, it's kind of it's dissatisfying. It's another way to say that is there's a kind of an insecurity with that we can just recognize as part of the human condition. It's not to get depressed about it necessarily. It's just to recognize, oh, there is that vulnerability in life, that things are changing. Sometimes, hallelujah, right? I mean, it's so nice when it pops out of, like, if you might be in a mind state where it's really painful and believing all these negative thoughts out of yourself, about yourself, and then suddenly it's like, oh, it really feels like, did anyone have that experience? Feels like you're just waking up from a dream. It's like it was just a dream. And then there's this sense of peace or ease or just you know, you don't need to believe that. Well, that's the moment of freedom. So this wise understanding of life as it is, and then wise thought. You know, how do we direct our thoughts? You know, what can we let go of the negative ones? It's not like they're going to stop coming, but we don't have to believe them. We certainly don't have to indulge them. There's so many opportunities for this, isn't there, with this instant culture, push the button and then the email goes out. Ooh, right? When we're feeling really distressed or upset about something. Ooh, it's easier to do that when you don't see somebody. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Wow, it's a great practice. Like, okay, maybe I can put this in the draft box. Now just let it sit. And then just see. Thich Nhat Hanh used to give this instruction that if you're angry with someone, take a year to really explore it. Then talk to them. It's interesting. So how we direct our thoughts. It's not that, you know, let's just be real. It's not that anger is bad or wrong or doesn't arise. It's a natural, it's an emotion. And it, you know, it's in response to life. It certainly can be in response to injustice. And sometimes the feeling itself will inform, particularly if we're mindful of it and engaged in it and understand its source, not when it's just a reactive response. We may be responding in the world in relationship to that in more ways than one. Mm-hmm. I think if anything, this practice, at least for myself, it's supported more courage to act in the world, as opposed to, some people say, you know, Buddhism, like, you know, reinforces passivity. I would say not at all. But it does reinforce attunement and non-reactivity. And it is worthy to take that kind of time when we can to reflect on what's skillful. Or, as the Buddha said, once it's happened, once that email's gotten sent, and you're sitting with later, like, oh, you reread the first email, it's like, wow, it wasn't that bad. You know, I took this the wrong way. And he says, like, remorse comes up. Okay, but that's not, you know, we don't have to, like, sink in that remorse. We can use it as information, like, okay. Maybe it would have been helpful to pause. Oh, I see more clearly what this person was trying to say to me. You know, and depending on the response, it might even call up I apologize for not understanding clearly or reacting. Or, you know, that's the beauty of this practice, where it invites us to engage in the world in more skillful ways than just reacting, like a ping pong ball. Boom, you know. So wise thinking. We can also cultivate in wise thinking these positive qualities, like we practice here with loving kindness practice, with compassion practice. I think, can't remember, early on in the retreat, I shared with you this story about just recognizing the when I was upset with a sibling, and really what helped me shift that was the discomfort inside myself. It wasn't like you're a good person or you're a bad person. It was like, this doesn't really feel, it's not getting me what I want, which is really relief from the pain. It's just relief from the upset, the pain, the hurt, you know? And so just like taking time to wisely reflect when we can. You may say, well, is there any room for like positive thinking and reflection in Dharma practice? Absolutely. You know, on an intensive retreat, we don't reinforce that because we're really, this is like a precious amount of time to really kind of actually examine the breakdown of experience, you know, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and our relationship to it. But certainly in our home life, using reflective time, other than just trying to think, we don't get to wisdom by overthinking. But sitting down, sitting with some quiet time and some mindfulness, presence, we might ask, you know, wow, is this the time to retire? You know, so these are not small questions. Should I do chemotherapy? You know, should I stay in my marriage? Like, these are not like, let me just figure this out. You know, it brings up anxiety, fear, doubt, all the hindrances. So we can just reflectively ask the question and see what arises. So maybe there's fear. So slowing down. Maybe we're just going to be present with, I don't know the answer to that. And my heart's beating fast. And or I feel really sad. Or it may be, well, I don't want to face this, but I know this is the right thing. You know, but that time for reflection and slowing down and paying attention to the body. The body tells the truth. The mind gets caught. It's not as reliable. So we need that body base to open the door for wisdom to come through. So So cultivating goodwill, like I said, we can cultivate positive thoughts. We can cultivate loving kindness and compassion. We can open to the possibility of forgiveness, whether it's self-forgiveness or forgiveness of another. Another way we can work with thought relate to thought is how addictive patterns come up in the mind. And this is a big one. And honestly, I think it just needs a lot of patience. That's been my experience anyway. Particularly when there's a resolve and retreat, I'm not going to do this anymore. Anyone have had that at all? When I go home, it's going to be different. May it be so. And don't be surprised. And so what do we, does that lead to doubt? You know, either I'm terrible, this practice doesn't work, or that was just a dream being on retreat. Or is it like, oh, okay, conditioned habit is strong energy. And so I'm thinking of one of my teachers, and we were talking about like the habit to open the cabinet door and go for the sweets. And he's like, well, you know, maybe you could just put those big punching mitts on, you know, so it would be harder to open the door. I thought that was a great idea. I didn't get the mitts. But I do think of them, you know, and sometimes it helps. You know, like those, that habitual behavior towards, you know, when it has the addictive quality to it, it can be helpful just to try to notice, like, is this going to give me what I want? Just even slowing down with that question can be really juicy and helpful. Or is this necessary right now? Do I really need it? Even though some part of me is like, yes, 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 I do. The ways we can work with thought. But if the expectation that, you know, the difficult isn't going to arise, we're just going to suffer more. So it really does call for these qualities of patience and kindness and wisdom, just knowing this is part of the human condition. And of course, mindfulness. Because without mindfulness, and that's really the last three of the Eightfold Path, wise effort, concentration, and wise mindfulness, which is what we've been practicing all week. So that is good fuel, because when we can't see clearly, we can't see clearly. So if we, and we'll probably talk about this more tomorrow, but putting energy into taking time to cultivate mindfulness, meditating, you know, having a practice, if you can, you know, during the day, even if it's shorter, even if it's 15 minutes, you know, where we just take the time to cultivate the quality of seeing clearly helps all these. It's a foundational piece for all these other ways of understanding life in ourselves. So the Buddha talked about three. The Buddha talked about the practice of non-harm as essential to liberation of the mind and heart. And, you know, one metaphor is like if you want to get to a free mind and heart and don't practice ethical conduct or morality, it's like trying to row a boat with it still tied at the dock. It's not going to go anywhere. You know, so this attention to skillful, non-harm, ethical conduct is really essential to a spiritual practice. And the three that are in the Eightfold Path, so there's wise view, there's wise thought, and then the three practices of non-harm are wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. And it's interesting that wise speech has its own category. It doesn't take a lot of thinking to understand why. You know, speech has such a powerful impact, doesn't it? Do you find that? The speech, the internal speech towards ourselves, many of you have talked about that, can feel so harsh or seductive in different ways. And the speech in our relational lives, it's a big part of our life. Somehow when I was practicing very early on, so a little obviously deluded about this one, but just somehow my speech was going to, you know, after my first retreat, my speech was just going to be just so kind and thoughtful and wise, and I don't think I was even out of the building before. You know, I was regretting something that I said, you know. I mean, it wasn't like it was awful. It was just, oh, you know, you start to see more clearly when you're meditating, like, oh, how was that for that person? So it's a practice. This is really important about speech. It really is a practice. I love, on my office desk at home, there's a little card someone gave me, and I have it on my desk, and it says it's quoted from the Buddha. I don't know if that's exactly true, but it's a good statement, which is, you know, fall down 7 times, get up 8. Well, that's a great way to understand our practice. It kind of keeps us going. It's like that, isn't it? So it's not, you know, if we're sort of swarming in shame and regret, and that was awful that I said that, you know, in some ways we can peek through that and say, oh, this is a grasping for perfection here. It's just a grasping for, like, somehow wanting to be above the human race. You know, good luck. It's not really how it happens. But we do get more attuned to the impact of our speech, and that's the beauty of the practice. So it's not a practice we need to be afraid of, practicing wise speech. We can be encouraged by it because you kind of get instant feedback. You know, the more conscious we are of the impact of our speech, the more that feedback comes. It doesn't necessarily even come from the other person. It can come from inside ourselves. One of the things the Buddha said about speech is there's certain areas of speech. He suggested that we contemplate and attend to with vigilance, really. And one is not lying. That the impact of lying, it, on one simple level, it confuses people. But on a larger level, it really undermines our ability to trust. And that's corrosive. That's corrosive. And there's different kinds of lying. There's the lying that's, you know, maybe one extreme of betrayal. There's the lying that's an exaggeration. Sometimes we exaggerate. Sometimes when you think of the political arena, it's like, wow, it's just lying is like accepted. You know, it's a practice, really. And it's confusing. Like, how do you truly believe what someone's saying if it's an acceptable practice, really? So we can investigate that for ourselves. It's interesting, a quote from Nietzsche. He once said, "I'm not upset that you lied to me, but that I now can't believe you anymore." So again, with our speech, you know, if there is lying, like, what's the motivation? Is it we think we're not good enough, so we need to exaggerate something? Is there greed? Is there fear? Is there somehow fear that the truth is not enough? So another caveat around speaking. The Buddha talked about speaking at the right time. And I think this is a wonderful teaching. Because sometimes people will say, well, okay, so if I'm not going to lie, I'm just going to say what I think. Well, sometimes that's really not very skillful. You know? And so is the timing right? You know, is the timing right? Is our speech in accordance with facts, the truth? What is useful? One speaks of the Dharma. So what does he mean by that? That it's truthful, that it has kindness in it. It's the right moment. Our speech, when speech is like a treasure, it's uttered at the right moment, it's accompanied by reason, it's moderate, and full of sense. It's spoken gently. What is said is beneficial and spoken with a mind of loving kindness. Because sometimes we actually do need to speak. Sometimes something that we know might be difficult for another. So can we do that with the best of our intention? Loving kindness? Is it the right time? Is it beneficial? Can we, you know, root in our own Dharma practice in that engagement to the best of our ability? Other kinds of speech the Buddha instructed to pay attention to are gossip and slander. And gossip is really, it's an interesting one. I remember Joseph Goldstein once saying he made a vow that he would not talk about other people unless they were present. And what he said was, I had very little to talk about. That's what he learned from that. You know, and actually it's wonderful to talk with another about something lovely about someone. And it's uplifting. Oh yeah, so-and-so, you know, did this lovely thing. Or it's very uplifting. That's like, you know, fuel for the heart. But when we talk about someone, they did this or they did that, maybe we're hurt. I'm not saying you never talk with another person to get guidance about how to deal with something. But if we're just kind of just dying to say it, you know, it can kind of feel like, and how is this landing for the other person? And really, how true is it? How much is it some objective truth or some way we've been triggered, or there's a perception there that may not be fully accurate? It does impact the other person. And ultimately impacts the person we're talking about, because it may impact the person we're speaking to, how they think about that person. So it's really interesting it's a practice. I mean, it's certainly not a perfected one, but it can be helpful to tune into. Is this skillful right now? And I do want to underline that I'm not suggesting that we never, you know, engage with another who we trust if we're struggling in a relationship, or if somebody has done something harmful that we need to work through our process. That's a very skillful use of talking about our experience. And we kind of know it doesn't... It might in a moment feel good if someone says, oh yeah, that person's really horrible and they did this to me and that. It doesn't really help. You really want to be free from you know, where the pain is. So it's helpful when we can engage with someone who has some Dharma understanding, even if they're not in this practice, but has some wise understanding about that. Frivolous speech. That's kind of interesting. One time I was walking with a friend. She's a friend and also another Dharma teacher. And she puts herself right out there. And we're walking along. She said, I was talking. She said, can we just be quiet for a while? And it was like, boom. At first I was a little irritated. And then it was like, wow, I can do that. I can do that. And just let me kind of let me tune into not having to judge, but kind of just like what was motivating the conversation. And it might just be simply that there's different needs there. But we can pay attention to like frivolous speech. You can sort of feel like, okay, I'm sort of done with this. If you're hearing someone else just chitty chat, I mean, sometimes it's really just fun, but sometimes we don't need it. We can just be quiet with another. I mean, you certainly learn that you're in community here and not talking with each other, and it's pretty fine, isn't it? So we can explore that in our engagement with others. It can be draining, I think, really the Buddha was saying. It can drain our energy. And harsh speech, the Buddha talked about, any kind of harsh speech, you know, is worthy of reflecting upon. Like, is it necessary? Is it needed to describe our situation even? So speech is a big one, and you know, certainly worthy of ongoing reflection and practice. And then action, wise action, you know, not taking life. That's a whole big reflection, isn't it? Like, when, you know, sometimes people will say, well, what do you do if you have, you know, pests in, you know, issue in your house? And I just recently, my mother's 98 and she lives by herself, and she's vulnerable. She has significant memory loss. She has help that comes in, and her, you know, there were mice in her house, and I just had to make a difficult decision. But I trust that it was the right one, because it was not only agitating her, but agitating me when I was sitting on her couch and I heard this little scratch behind me. It's a little scratchy scratch, you know, and then it's like, I looked at, like, boom, just, whoa, that was close to the back of my neck. But that meant, you know, I did talk with the specialist about it, and, you know, they have a great reproductive systems, and they do multiply. And I just had to face the reality that wishing that they would go off into their little holes and not come in the house wasn't going to make them go away. So I had to make a decision around, as they call it, pest control. And it was painful. Not that I had to see them, not alive anymore, but in seeing them alive and knowing they're living creatures, I asked their forgiveness, quite honestly. Yeah. So sometimes, I give you that example, because sometimes we need to make decisions that are difficult. And one of the functions that are helpful is when, you know, literally one of the treatments is blocking up the holes. It's an older home. Blocking up the holes in the house helps them not come back in again. Same with, you have ants, like the things you can do to prevent them from coming back. It's a gesture towards non-harm. So not killing. Some of us need to eat meat for our health of our bodies. I mean, these are reflective practices. There's not a harsh line with this. It's just something to keep in mind. Not killing, not taking life. We've already talked about wise speech. Also, not taking what doesn't belong to us. And this is a powerful practice. It's not just, well, I don't steal, but, you know, where are the ways sometimes we grab the line at the grocery store, even though we know that person was waiting, or, but I'm in a rush, I only have a few things, you know, or perhaps when we're in a group, maybe if we tend to be extroverted, sometimes, it's not conscious, but sometimes we can even, this is going to sound strong here, but, you know, sometimes we can even steal another's time without realizing it. Like, can we settle back? Can we renounce the need to get more? You know, so it's an interesting reflection of taking what isn't freely offered. The whole movement for reparations in this country is really an investigation into that. You know, what does it mean to be honest about the history of racism, and the impact of that in terms of what wasn't offered to a whole group of people just based on the color of their skin, and where we are now, and what's a skillful way of repairing, which involves facing the truth of that harm. Mm. of the harm of taking what wasn't freely given. A whole life and integrity, another being. So that's a powerful reflection, and it's wonderful. It's painful, of course, but it's wonderful to see that that's arising in our culture right now. That's the good coming from being aware of the impact of harm. You know, in all the ways we may look at inside ourselves, the impact of privilege, and you know, we don't have to drown in guilt, but we can really reflect upon what's right relationship here? What's wise action? You know, maybe actually just if we have that capacity, maybe just even offering our money to things, to causes we believe in, that act of generosity and reciprocity and reparation can be really beautiful and helpful. And I don't say this out of like a should, or it's more just to really connect with the power of generosity, power of action that lifts up the heart. And there's many ways we can do that. So another thing about wise action, actually I just want to say a few things about wise livelihood, because that's another place that came up in several conversations in some small groups. Wise livelihood. Sometimes we may be deeply involved in service work, and people tell you what great work you do and how wonderful that is, and sometimes we can be really withering in it. So wise livelihood doesn't mean to necessarily sacrifice ourselves, you know, for the benefit of others. It may be that we examine how we relate, both to ourselves and others in our work life, and see, you know, see where the balance is, see where the generosity is, both towards self and other. There's so much, really, in what I'm just touching on here, and I just want to honor, you know, all of you that have brought these questions up, you know, in the small groups or in the large group here, that it is a process of living our lives in a wise and loving way. It's a practice. It's imperfect, and yet, as someone said in one of the small groups, you know, what's the alternative? You know, and I don't mean to say, oh yeah, Buddhism is the way. It's really the teachings of the Buddha. They can apply to any practice of one's religious faith. You know, these teachings are very accessible. They don't require some kind of signing on or identification. I'm this or I'm that. It's just what... I love that the Buddha said, like, see for yourself, which is what you've been doing all week. See for yourself. How is this? You know, that's the practice. And it flowers into all these pieces that, you know, I'm speaking about here today. Like, we can apply it in the complexity of our lives, in the beauty of our lives, in the difficulty of our lives, in our relational world. It's humbling, and it's also deeply inspiring. Fall down 7 times, get up 8. And thank you for listening. Maybe we can sit together. May the sincerity of our practice protect us in our lives and serve as a benefit to all beings everywhere, without exception. Thank you for listening and for your beautiful offering here of your practice and your presence. It is a gift to every single one of us. And I deeply appreciate that. Thank you.